I recently had the opportunity to apply this in a court. I went in with clients to a superior court. The clients were accused of a felony crime, and the judge did not want to allow me to provide them assistance of counsel because I hadn't joined that state's bar association. However, I had a private contract with those clients to advocate and counsel them and provide for their best interest in this proceeding. Well, the judge saw on his list that there were two defendants and three people walked up to the defense side of the bench. And the judge says, wait a minute, I need to know who everybody is here. And I said, hello, Your Honor, I'm Kenneth Wayne. I'm here as an obligation of a contract to provide counsel, spokesman, and advocate services by private power of attorney for my clients. And the judge says, well, are you a member of the bar? I says, Your Honor, if your question is, have I been admitted to practice by the Washington Supreme Court, and am I a member of the Washington State Bar Association? The answer is no. I'm here as an obligation of a contract as protected by Article 1, Section 10 of the Federal Constitution. And the judge says, well, we have a law here that you can't practice law if you're not an attorney. And I said, Your Honor, let me see if I understand your position correctly. Is it your position to intentionally, knowingly, and willfully impair the obligations of a contract? And the judge sits up in his chair and he says, nobody's going to get ambushed in my courtroom today. This case is continued. You go out in the hallway with the prosecutor and you decide when you want to have something heard. And that was the end of the case for the day. The judge knew that he had been walked into a corner and there was no way out. Why did he know that? There are several other cases that explain it. A case called United States versus Dent. The government is prohibited from forcing one to choose between two constitutionally protected rights. You have the right to counsel. You have the right to association. The Supreme Court says the right to association also means the right to not associate. My clients did not want to associate with an officer of the state for their counsel. They also have the right to due process. The court can't say you only get one of those. The court must uphold all of them. Then there's the issue of immunity. To give you an idea of how strong they think their immunity is, they are taught in judicial college that as long as you're sitting on that bench, you can never be accountable for anything. If you do it wrong, the appellate courts will try and find a way to justify what you did, and if they absolutely can't, they'll overturn it and send it back with instructions on how to do it right, and then you're off the hook anyway. However, it is not nearly that powerful in spite of their training. I had the opportunity one day in Seattle Municipal Court. In a proceeding, the judge said, I don't care what the law is, this is the way I'm going to do it. At that point, I informed the judge that he was under arrest, and I pulled out my cell phone, turned it on, and called 911. I says, hi, I'm up here at room 840 of the Dexter Horton building. I've just made a citizen's arrest, and I need a police officer to come take my prisoner into custody. The suspect is a white male, 35 to 45 years of age, dark hair, balding, and wearing a black dress. Whereupon the judge jumped up from the bench and went running through the side door of the courtroom. I stepped out the main door of the courtroom. And moments later, here comes the judge without his black dress on, at a dead run, with four armed court marshals surrounding him, running for the elevators to escape before the police could get there. He knew where the power of the people was, and he knew he had just gotten outranked, and he knew the people had come a-calling. I did not know enough to thoroughly overcome his claim of immunity, but I did have formal criminal charges filed against him, and he was forced to come and answer. The charges were ultimately dismissed on judicial immunity because at that time I did not know the procedure to overcome that. In a case called Egger v. City of Livingston, it says a state judge does not enjoy judicial immunity from unconstitutional behavior when facts are sufficient to grant party declaratory or injunctive relief against the judge. If you can get a declaratory judgment that the judge was unconstitutional, you can then sue him and he will have no immunity. There are several cases, Wall versus McIver, Pulliam versus Allen, in which it says judicial immunity concerns only monetary liability and does not bar injunctive relief against judicial officers acting in a judicial capacity. And then, of course, once you've got that injunctive relief, they said you did it wrong, you have to do it right, then you go back up and say, oh, under Livingston, since I got injunctive relief, you no longer have immunity from my damages suit. How about federal judges? Mendenhall versus Goldsmith. For purposes of immunity analysis, federal officials are indistinguishable from state officials and receive no greater degree of protection from constitutional claims. So even federal judges can be sued. I find it very interesting that the qualification that the Founding Fathers put on continuing in office in a federal judgeship was very, very affirmative standard. Federal judgeship, we've all been told, is for lifetime tenure, and it's almost impossible to get rid of them. However, let's go back to the Constitution. What does the Constitution actually say? It says they have lifetime tenure during good behavior. Good behavior is an affirmative standard. Not, can you prove they did something wrong, but can they prove that they acted properly and in the right frame of mind and with the right intent? Are they in good behavior or are they just in behavior? According to the Constitution, they must remain in good behavior for lifetime tenure. Another statement on immunity. Immunity is an affirmative defense to damage liability. It does not bar actions for declaratory or injunctive relief. Therefore, individual defendants cannot claim immunity as an affirmative defense to an action seeking declaratory or injunctive relief. And you would be surprised how many attorneys will try and assert immunity even when you're only suing for declaratory judgment. Just to summarize that, declaratory judgment is a tool that we can use as the people to determine whether or not our employees, who are government officials, acted within the scope of their duties and therefore have any immunity, or whether or not they acted outside the scope of constitutional government and have no immunity because they acted outside of what they were supposed to be doing. One of the tools to hold them to the Constitution is their oath of office contract required by Article 6, Section 3 of the Federal Constitution. That requires every state and federal officer, legislative, judicial, and executive, before entering upon the duties of office, to take an oath or affirmation contract binding them to uphold the federal Constitution. Since that contract is executed before they enter on the duties of office, that is something that can never be defended with official immunity. A breach of contract provides certain remedies. Since they have sworn to uphold the Constitution and laws of the United States, that means they agree to be subject to the laws that say that there are penalties for violating the people's rights. Violating the people's rights can carry a penalty of up to 10 years in prison. If we the people learn and know and are willing to prosecute them. In the training you are receiving, you will learn about many different circumstances where it may be appropriate to use administrative procedures to resolve disputes with business and government. When necessary, declaratory judgment may be used to separate an official from his office when he violated the law. That may be statutory law, it may be constitutional law. Now, we have to understand how courts obtain jurisdiction of a case before we can figure out how to get into that court and get it to do the job that we think that it's supposed to do. One of the first premises that we have to understand is that courts have jurisdiction by the agreement of the parties. That's why when you file a case, the other party has to put in a notice of appearance if they want to participate. Otherwise, they lose by default. By saying nothing, they also grant the court jurisdiction to enter the default. That agreement may be in one of two forms. Either you agree as to the facts and the law, or you agree that you disagree. Now, why would you go to court if you agree on the facts and the law? Well, maybe there is a remedy that you want, money damages, curative relief, give back property, do a particular duty. If you agree on the facts and the law, but they have not performed, you may want to get a declaratory judgment that your agreement on the facts and the law is valid, and then get an order to compel performance, which may be money damages, it may be doing their duty, it may be returning property. There are many different things that are remedies to various situations which may need to be resolved even though you agree on the facts and the law. The purpose of the administrative common law proceeding that we've been discussing is to seek agreements and find out what all we can agree on. The key to minimizing the likelihood of the need to litigate judicially is to use your subpoena powers administratively to get your adversary to state that the adversary does not have the necessary evidence to make a claim. Then all you have to do is agree. The judicial powers of the court may not be invoked except in case of actual controversy. You cannot put the court into its capacity as a judicial court unless you have some type of actual controversy that you have agreed on. It may be fact, it may be law, it may be performance or remedy. The controversy may be over the facts, and that's what we generally see going to trial when we watch various court TV. Many of us watch Perry Mason growing up. Well, was it a fact whether or not this party killed the victim? What do the facts show? Well, Perry always seemed to have an innocent client and had a wonderful opportunity to win because he was always able to get somebody else to confess, which was great for his client. Sometimes it's not quite that easy. Someone may have actually done it, but it's still up to the state to prove all the facts necessary to get a conviction. There are many he said, she said cases, as Judge Judy taught us as we talked earlier. Bring your paper, bring your proof. That way the court has something to work with. In administrative procedures relating to debt issues, you use administrative procedures to obtain assertions from the alleged creditor that they do not have the records to state an obligation. If you don't have the records to state an obligation, you have no proof of obligation. This is something that you can agree with. Services such as IRS Codebusters will show you how to get the Commissioner of Internal Revenue to assert as a fact that you do not have any federal income tax obligations. This is something you can agree with. We see cases every day where the Commissioner of Internal Revenue responds with letters saying, "We have no documents responsive to your request when we ask for documents proving that there was a tax obligation." This is something we can agree with. Now, if the commissioner's agents, through one of the Internal Revenue Services, has gone out and created a lien or a levy or brought other types of proceedings to interfere with your liberty or your property, once you have the commissioner's agreement that there was no tax obligation, you can take that agreement to court and ask the court to enforce the lack of an obligation, which means they must cure any enforcement actions or collection actions being taken by the IRS agents. These exact same principles can be used with any government regulatory scheme. Land use, wetlands, licensing, and many of the other regulatory things that government gets involved with. This also is the perfect procedure for dealing with any business disputes you may encounter, whether it's over whether you owe a bill or not, whether you have an obligation to perform under a contract. Any potential business dispute can be resolved through the exact same common law administrative proceedings where you first go to the party. You want to do it in writing because, as Judge Judy points out, if you got paper, you have evidence. No paper, no evidence. So you put your claims in writing. You go to them privately and say, "This is my understanding of our duties and our obligations, and what our rights are." Give them the opportunity to respond and see what they agree with, what they disagree with, and set a complete record that you can take to court. These principles are applicable to many of the procedures you will learn in this training program. To empower you to use these principles, you must stay current by taking advantage of the updates and seminars providing support and ongoing training. But I want to make it very, very, very clear. While I make most of my money from litigation, I encourage you to avoid litigation if there is any reasonable alternative.
For additional information on this topic, go to your online resource center at www.pqionline.cc. Click on Products and Solutions and go to Disc number 6.